American History F'd. Conclusion. The natural state. Critical thinking question. Imagine if we all woke up tomorrow and government was gone. All governments, all over the world, all individuals calling themselves government had vanished. Now at that point, imagine this. Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong does go wrong. And one of the worst possible chains of events that I can imagine anyway goes into motion. What would the eventual outcome look like? What would the world look like if the worst fears of a respectful and peaceful person all came true? And most importantly, how would most people supporting the state today for its apparent ability to protect and provide and maintain order, how would those people feel about perhaps the most tragic and chaotic outcome of this stateless world? Well, that would seem like a pretty easy question for them to answer. But it's not. And I sincerely hope that realization helps ease some fears about the eventual demise of the state. Everybody, and welcome to another installment of the series American History F'd, where we take a look at popular myths about history and culture and politics and civics and government itself, things that are pounded into our fragile little minds from a very, very young age, and things that continue to be built upon throughout our entire experience in the government schools. Because, of course, we know that if you want people to believe strange or insane or even destructive things are good for them, you have to get them when they're very, very young. This strategy has also proven to be very effective for religion and cigarettes. But it's true for government and the government schools as well. So this is the eighth installment in that series, looking at the way we are taught history, or the way we are taught about government in a system of so-called education run by the government. So the title of today's show is The Natural State. And I think it's fair to say that one of the most persistent and stubbornly held beliefs or myths in human civilization today, as it has been for some time, is the idea that the state is necessary. Of course, we all leave our government education thinking that the state is necessary, because we also learned that it is totally awesome. In fact, whenever I start to discuss my ideas or my philosophy with other people, with statists or political people, I quickly encounter a lot of outrage, ridicule, and indignation, sort of this scornful question about were you just not paying attention in the 12 years of government-controlled school that the government forced you to attend while they were teaching you all the good things about government, especially our government here in America? So a lot of people will say that government is good. Government is good. It solves important problems in your life. It keeps you safe and helps you out.
And boy, you shouldn't even be complaining. I really think it's outrageous that you would be this ungrateful.
Now, slightly more reasonable and rational people will tell you that government is a necessary evil. We couldn't get by without it.
There's just some things that have to be done by government, they'll tell you. But those are two, I guess you could say, distinct types of people. The ones who say government is good, and the ones who just will not admit, because they're still wrong, but say that government is not good, but a necessary evil.
And if you have a conversation with one person long enough, you might even see them be both people, and maybe even a third type of person. You see, when a conversation with the average statist starts, you, the libertarian, or the person who's arguing from the philosophy of liberty,
or, you know, first principles like the axiom of non-aggression, you are clearly insane because government is good.
But if you persist with your points and you persist with your questions about their point of view, you'll find that 10, 15, 20 minutes, 150 years into the conversation, they will have retreated to a new position, that government is necessary. And if you continue for another 5 or 10 minutes or 6 days or 2 centuries, they will even retreat from that position, usually, and say, hey, man, that's the way it is. That's the law. That's democracy. That's how it goes. I think it's important to point out to people in these conversations when that happens, too. Let them know. Do you realize that you, as I've presented more of my ideas and asked more questions about your ideas, that you've retreated from your initial position that this thing was good to this thing is necessary to, hey, man, this thing exists? That's important.
And, you know, I do believe that a lot of these conversations are worth having and people can be persuaded. But I think, of course, you would reach a point with somebody where you realize that you're just having the same conversation over and over again and you're not getting anywhere. It might be worth checking out a video, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's a speech that Stefan Molyneux gave at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum last year, where he introduces something called the against me argument, where he personalizes the violence of the state. And if people will say that they support violence against you, that's a good way to save yourself a whole bunch of future frustration and heartache, because you don't have to talk to that person anymore. Only one good answer to the question, do you support the use of violence against me? And this should not be the first conversation that you have with somebody about politics or ethics or philosophy or education. But it certainly can be the last if they answer incorrectly.
But the idea that the state is necessary joins two other ideas in the triad of the three most widely held and persistent ideas in human history. The second is the idea that
the existence of some kind of supernatural being who found the time to create all of us is necessary to establish morality, that human beings need God to be good. They could not figure out how to do that without the guidance of God. In other words, we are all born evil, but finding God gives us a chance to be good. And the third idea is that no society that is even somewhat reliant on agriculture for its survival, which is all societies ever, could ever work or ever expect to thrive if there was not some form of forced labor to take care of the agriculture. Throughout most of time, this has been called slavery, and it was actually, for most of time, considered to just be a very natural and acceptable phenomenon of human civilization.
Now, I have good news about two of these ideas, the slavery and the God thing, but we're working on the third one today, anyway, and, you know, in the whole larger School Sucks podcast. So again, these two very, very common views that I encounter, the first one being government is good, and the second one being government is a necessary evil, which is just a slightly more rational-sounding way of saying pretty much the same thing. If something is necessary, it's hard to make the argument that it's some kind of catastrophic moral evil. So both pretty much are the same thing, and both pretty much require ignoring the fact that the entire institution is based on the initiation of force and the threat of violence. Now, when people have a mode of operating that is entirely backed up by violence.
In listening to how they talk and observing how they interact with others,
we can kind of see a bravado that comes from knowing that if all else fails, we can point guns. So here's one example. This is from the 1990 Martin Scorsese movie Goodfellas.
This is the main character Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, explaining why the mob likes to go into the restaurant business.
The guy's got Paulie as a partner. Any problems, he goes to Paulie. Trouble with the bill, he can go to Paulie. Trouble with the cops, deliveries, Tommy, he can call Paulie. But now the guy's got to come up with Paulie's money every week, no matter what. Business bad? Fuck you, pay me. Oh, you had a fire? Fuck you, pay me. Place got hit by lightning, huh? Fuck you, pay me.
What if I get one of those TVs?
Nah, I'll be sorry.
And then finally, when there's nothing left,
fucking shame.
When you can't borrow another buck from the bank or buy another case of booze, you bust the joint out. You light a match.
Any help reaching anything?
You look like you're decorating a Christmas.
Now you're probably saying, boy, that sounded a little cantankerous. Well, over time, these types of thugs and extortionists did develop more subtle ways of communicating the same message to their victims. So here's one example of that, even though this one, again, is fictional. This is from the HBO series The Sopranos, where two members of the Soprano family go into a new business in their neighborhood and attempt to offer what they call a protection service.
Manager Dale, welcome to the neighborhood. We're from the North Ward Merchants Protective Cooperative.
I'm kind of busy. You guys looking for a donation?
Let him finish.
You may have noticed, not to denigrate anyone, but this is a transitional neighborhood. I mean, demographically speaking, you still have a lot of marginal types.
And we merchants have found you really should have some round-the-clock security here.
Isn't that what the police are for?
They do their best, but they got their hands full. Your weekly dues to us will give you all the supplemental safety net you'll ever need.
I can't authorize anything like that. It'd have to go through corporate in Seattle.
We merchants prefer to deal on a personal, one-on-one basis.
I don't have any discretionary funds. It's got to go through corporate.
But how do you think corporate would feel if, for the sake of argument, someone threw a brick through your window?
They've got like 10,000 stores in North America. I don't think they feel anything.
What if, God forbid, it wasn't just vandalism? What if an employee, even the manager, say, was assaulted?
Now, isn't it interesting how when these sociopathic thugs are clearly going in to threaten somebody, like the whole purpose of the interaction is a threat to get money, they make it sound like it's they're doing a favor for the person they're threatening? Here's another example. This one is actually from, this is not fiction, and it's not the mafia, even though these people are using exactly the same technique, making a threat sound like a favor. This is from the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue. This is a commercial that's running on television right now
in the state of Pennsylvania, which incidentally, the people who are being threatened by it are paying for, which is, here it is.
Your name is Tom. You live just off of Fifth Street. Nice car, Tom. Nice house. What's not so nice is you owe Pennsylvania $4,212 in back taxes. Listen, Tom, we can make this easy. Pay online by June 18th, and we'll skip your penalty and take half off your interest. Because, Tom, we do know who you are.
Now, of course, there's an incredible amount of frustration and despair from knowing that you're being aggressed against and really having nothing in the immediate that you can do about it. Nothing right now, nothing today that can change that in any dramatic way. So there's kind of two ways to go forward from there. Number one is you can resign yourself to doing something meaningful, something to change that, to learn more, to speak out, to act in accordance with your values as much as you can against that institution of violence. The other kind of path that you could go down there is to try to rationalize it somehow. Try to make it good. Try to make it necessary. Let's jump back to the mob for a minute, right? Like if you're being extorted by the mafia, as a lot of people are, there's still plenty of mob families and organized crime in a non-governmental organized crime in America.
So imagine yourself in this situation for a minute. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, and you just have to deal with it.
And you just had to kind of deal with that frustration of, like, working for something and having it stolen from you. Wouldn't you try to, like, God, I don't know, make it okay somehow? Just to deal with that unrest? Like, the mobster comes in, as I was saying in the last episode, the mob comes in and they say, you're going to pay us $300 in protection money every week. And you know it's just a total shakedown. You know, you're not getting anything out of that. It's like, give us the money or we'll hurt you. Right? Now, I would think that to deal with this frustration and anger and just helpless feeling, that you would want to picture the mobster, like, taking that money and sending, little Mario Jr. to a fun summer camp, or buying Mario and his brothers, Peter and Paulie, some toys, and they're really happy, and you can just see the smiles on their face.
You don't want to picture, like, strip clubs and cocaine and hollow point bullets and shovels coming out of that money.
I mean, that sucks. Knowing that there's nothing that you can do about that, you want to picture a happy, fun time for little Mario and Peter and Paulie. So you can see that people really, really work extraordinarily hard to play the same exact trick on themselves when it comes to this other form of largely socially acceptable organized crime, the state. The rationalizations, the explanations, the apologies. I forget who said it, but somebody, you know, political people are the ultimate innocents. They always can tell themselves that this is the person who's going to turn things around, or this is the time that they're not being lied to. People who are in other aspects of their life so intelligent and successful, just looking like Charlie Brown, thinking that this is the time that Lucy is really going to hold the football for him so he can kick it. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. But because when it comes to politics, they become non-conceptual. They become irrational, right? Because politics and support for the state is entirely irrational. And I will go as far to say is that it's immoral. It is immoral. So the complexity of mental gymnastics that needs to be done to make all that okay is very, very, very strenuous and elaborate for most people. But you know what's interesting? If a lot of these people that I'm being so critical of turned and looked back into the past at the other widely held beliefs that I spoke of, many of them would very, very quickly admit how silly those ideas were. And it almost kind of very easily reveals most of our ancestors as extremely silly and simple-minded, for lack of a better way of putting it. But I don't think that, you know, people were ever stupid, right? They certainly, human beings have never lacked the tools for attaining knowledge, especially curiosity. What they lacked was the information, right? So what happens when you have a surplus of curiosity and a shortage of information? Well, you get mythology. You know, somebody walks outside thousands of years ago, they see the sun coming up over the hills. They say, what is that thing? Where does it come from? Where was it last night? They make up a story. Right? There's never been any shortage of human curiosity and imagination. In fact, if you look around the world, you can see the amazing monuments from thousands of years ago that still stand as a testament to the power and the scope of the human imagination. Now, of course, those mythologies are also as well as, you know, creative and exciting and filled with, you know, neat stories, they're also very destructive. Because then we have the power of mythology, right? If people embrace these myths, they often become very predictable as they subscribe to, you know, a certain dogma related to those myths. And people who are in search of power for themselves have always gravitated to these impressionable folks to exploit the mythology for purposes of control. So, I mean, like with the other two ideas besides statism, it's very simple for us today and look back at slavery and most people's attitude about slavery 200 years ago, 400 years ago in the Roman Empire, in ancient Greece, and say, what were they thinking? How did people ever think that that was okay? How did people ever think it was like acceptable or even preferable to restrict certain people from access to human decency based on race or ethnicity? How would they have ever thought that that was natural? Why did it take them so long to get over that? The same thing with religion.
Now, of course, I might give a pass to like some 15th century European serf who, in a moment of curiosity, in the middle of a very, very busy day, said to his feudal lord, hey, I have a question for you. I noticed that just about every day I do about 17 hours of farm labor, and then I go and I sleep in this dirt floor shack with 9 other people and a couple of goats. And I was just wondering, like, why does my life suck so bad? And the feudal lord would have responded, well, if this is your life, this is clearly what God wanted for you. And the big guy gets a little bit angry when you question his will. Remember when he flooded the whole earth and killed everybody? So why don't you just get back to tilling the field, and maybe later, if you're good, I'll read you a couple passages from the only book that you've ever heard of, the Bible. But I wouldn't think that there'd be any excuse for us now. And sure, yeah, we were all fed mythology too. We talked about slavery. Who did we learn freed those people? Abraham Lincoln. But we, unlike that serf, have a way to deconstruct and remove that mythology that was once so powerful from our lives forever. And you know, in the world we live in today, this has gotten so much easier to do. It's almost getting hard not to do. Like, watch your parents, watch the people on the news, watch your teachers. They're like really struggling when they get confronted with these things. But, you know, recognizing a mythology doesn't automatically make it vanish.
These mythologies, these nonsense ideas that were pushed one way or another, or for one reason or another, further and further into the future. It wasn't like that when people gained access to more knowledge and more information, that the mythology just all at once dried up. You had a story that people had believed for so long, and as people could look at it closer and closer, and with a more kind of skeptical eye, they realized that that whole giant story was filled with these gaping holes. And it wasn't like the people who were using the mythology or using the story were like, ah, you got us. You're right. We give up. We're surprised it took you so long to figure it out. They don't do that. They make up new stories. Smaller mythologies with smaller holes to plug the big holes in the big mythology. And over time, maybe just like I was saying about the Catholic Church, maybe in the future they have to do it again. Right? The smaller holes in the smaller mythology, plugging the big hole in the big mythology, those are revealed. So they have to make up an even smaller mythology to stick in those holes with little teeny tiny holes. And eventually what you get with any mythology is just some kind of like big logic pasta strainer where the holes are small enough to catch most folks and only a few rational and conceptual individuals can manage to drip through. That's the idea of slavery. That's the whole institution of religion and statism.
And the idea that these three things are good or even just necessary. Like I said earlier, three of the most persistent, widely held, and stubbornly held beliefs in human history. And the good news about two of them, slavery and religion, is that most people have kind of moved beyond that. Slavery, for sure. Religion, I think we're kind of on our way. I think that we are a generation who really have a very good chance, I think, of seeing kind of acceptance of religion that existed when we were born versus the kind of acceptance of religion that we will see when we die. We'll really stand a very good chance, I think, of seeing a very, very dramatic change. And, you know, I think our parents' generation has seen a pretty
significant change too in how seriously people take religion between, you know, the 1950s and this decade that we're in right now.
I mean, I grew up Catholic, and we just, if you look at the history of Catholicism and just how many times they've had to retreat from their dogma or their position to stay semi-relevant in a increasingly rational world, it's really sad. And I mean, if you just look at where they are now, you would think that something like them being exposed as, or, you know, if they're upper echelons anyway, as just being this big hypocritical child molesting cult, that might be enough to put the final nail in the cross, if you will. And, you know, I should point out that one of my biggest frustrations when it comes to religion is the fact that it set us back. I mean, it set us back a good 1,000 years by providing nonsense answers to important questions. So that's slavery, that's religion. But what about statism? The last of these three great pervasive and destructive myths. What can we do about that? Why don't we once again take a look at the history education that somebody receives in public school?
And we can really even take this all the way up into college if the person, whoever we're talking about, is one of the, like, one in six people who does get some kind of history education after high school. Not that that's necessarily a good thing either. But, you know, it starts with a big dumb story. Starts with just a big stupid story that we kind of are forced to passively look at and accept from a distance. The idea that our government is good, our government is special, our country is special, we are special.
It's such a privilege for you to even be here. People died for your freedom, just like Jesus died for your sins, because why not just try to stretch the same piece of bullshit as much as you can before it snaps?
So you have all that mythological crap that's pounded into our heads when we're very, very young. And then history at the secondary level, as I talked about in the first installment of this history series, at the secondary level, it's just a bunch of boring names and dates, which really discourages people from wanting to look at history any further or really being interested in anything that's historical or political, which is really, as far as the state is concerned, the ideal condition for a citizen, to not be interested, to not care, to not pay attention. So, but at the same time, to retain all of the rich and magical stories about the country that they learned in the first 6 years of school. But as a history education continues, the big dumb story that we were fed when we were very little and impressionable starts to get closer. And we become more skeptical and more incredulous, and we realize that it's filled with big gaping holes. So, especially in the upper levels of high school education, you know, like the AP levels, we start to see the introduction of all these ideologies like utilitarianism and pragmatism. Now, these words might never, I'm guessing that these words are probably never even mentioned in high school, but it's what these ideologies are all about. That's the message that's embedded into the curriculum for the kids who have been sorted into the, you know, upper levels AP. They're going to have to get this stuff that plugs the big gaping holes and the stupid stories about their country and their government and their history that they were told when they were little.
These ideologies, pragmatism and utilitarianism, are essentially apologies or rationalizations for violence. When we were in first grade, adults made the world so simple for us. You don't hurt other people. You don't take other people's stuff. Tell the truth. Those are some simple and very straightforward guidelines for how to be successful on a interpersonal or community level. But especially in these like AP courses in, you know, 12th grade, students are looking at their government anyway much closer. They're looking at politics much closer, and they're saying, wait a minute, most of the world doesn't work like I was taught to work in first grade or in kindergarten. They're also just a couple of steps away from realizing that the 76-year-old first grade teacher, Mrs. Frost, who told them these rules, her paycheck was not delivered to her every week by the idea that it's wrong to hurt other people or take their stuff.
something else is going on here. So ideologies need to come in as damage control. And we'll definitely be talking about utilitarianism and pragmatism more on this show in the future, but I just want to touch on them quickly. The first idea, utilitarianism, is the ideology of the greater good. And how convenient for statist intellectuals to have a word to describe the ideology that is probably one of the most vague words in our entire language, good. But essentially what it means is that the role of the state, the benevolent role of the state, is to deliver the greatest happiness to the greatest number of people. So, of course, some people are going to have to make another word that they left incredibly vague, sacrifices, right? In the interest of the greatest good for the greatest number of people. So whenever we see the guns or the bombs or the billy clubs or the jackboots of the state, utilitarianism trains us to say, oh, somebody must not have been pulling their load. Somebody must have not wanted to cooperate with everybody else. Just working our way along to the greatest good for the greatest number. So I really think that utilitarianism is just a damage control ideology, not just on the violence of the state, but on the idea of democracy itself. I mean, democracy is a 2,000-plus-year-old idea that it's like a sanitized version of might makes right. I'm bigger than you. I rule over you. That's all utilitarianism is. And it's not about individualism at all. It is the opposite of individualism. One of the great proponents of utilitarianism, a guy named John Stuart Mill, was pretty much a socialist. And wow, who would think that, you know, turning your back on individualism could lead to socialism, but I guess it happens. The other idea is pragmatism. Now, pragmatism is essentially the ideology of doing what works. Now, I'll give you, I don't want to get too much into this. This could be its own show, but the guy who was behind pragmatism was a guy named William James. Let me start us out with a quote by him. If the hypothesis of God works satisfactorily in the widest sense of the word, it is true. Think about that for a minute. If this hypothesis works satisfactorily in the widest sense of the word, it is true. In other words, the truth does not matter, and the pursuit of the truth is a waste of time if fantasies are more practical and convenient and expedient. And pragmatism has been called a practical philosophy. It has been called the philosophy of the future and the philosophy of the 20th century. And I think if we look at the death toll that governments brought upon their own citizens during the 20th century, we could definitely say, yes, pragmatism is the philosophy of the 20th century. But you know what? It's not a philosophy at all, because it's like an anti-philosophy. It says principles do not matter, just like utilitarianism. No principles, just effects. And, I mean, you could use this to justify anything. Let's try it out. Boy, there sure are a lot of people who are hungry who could use some vegetables, and oh, boy, there sure are a lot of crops that need to be picked. Hey, slaves will pick the crops. Slavery is good. If the desired outcome is to put food in people's mouth, the means to that end don't matter. They're good if they produce the desired outcome. Think about that. Think about what you could justify with this idea. The Holocaust. That's pragmatism, right? They called the murder, the mass murder of 6 million innocent people, a solution, and got away with that because this ideology had sunk its teeth into the minds of the people in Europe in the 1930s and the 1940s. But this is the lightweight spackle that is spread on the big giant statues of fantasy that were first shown when we're very young. And most people go for this. And one of the reasons why I get so upset about this is because these are not philosophies. These are not
even close to like a quest for the truth. They require no principles. They are inverted pyramids of logic. They start with nothing. Like, I always talk to students about how to make an argument, how to have a debate, how to persuade people, like through your writing. And I always use a pyramid, right? Like, at the bottom, at the foundation, just like a pyramid would not stand without this, at the foundation, there needs to be things that cannot be questioned, that are axiomatic, that are first principles. Like the idea that the initiation of force is wrong. And if you took that, if for somehow you couldn't, but if you could take that giant foundation out of our philosophical pyramid, the whole thing would collapse. But you can't. It's too solid. And most people, like I've said in this show many times already, work very, very hard not to see the foundation. They only want to look at the capstone, right? The conclusion. Oh, you're just anti-government. You're supposed to be cooperating with people. Haven't you ever heard of Jeremy Bentham? And I've dealt with some of these kids who are learning this stuff in high school. I remember telling a story, 5 or 6 months ago about this SAT class that I was teaching, and I was asking kids what they were learning about in school, and this one kid was all excited to tell me about this ethics class that he was taking, and he said to me, did you know that what Hitler and Mother Teresa did was ethically the same, because they both thought that they were doing the right thing? So I would prefer kids learning nothing about ethics rather than that kind of relativism. But that's a public school education. You start with the big dumb story. As we get older and we see the holes, new stories go into the holes. As we get even older and we see the holes in the stories that plug the holes, even littler stories with littler holes. And if you follow the history of government, it's exactly the same thing. Because just like the Pope and the Catholic Church had the clergy to do all these complex and high-minded sounding rationalizations, the state has the intellectuals and the university professors and the journalists to do the same work for them. And of course, the state used the clergy plenty as well. Let's not forget that. Now, I've said this on the show before, but I think it bears repeating once more in this series. How about we approach it like this? If we were to capture the history of Western governments to abbreviate and personify that history into a nice little, 2 or 3 minute package, it would sound something like this. Hey there, stranger. Is that yours? Okay, now it's mine. And I want to be very clear that if you put up enough resistance, I will just kill you. All right, transaction complete. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Wait a minute. This is not going to work in the long run because I'm really outnumbered. And most people are just not like me. And they wouldn't want to live in a world where people just go around enacting random violence on others to get what they want. So, all right, I need to come up with some kind of story here. Hey, guess what, everybody? I'm God. So you're really just going to want to do what I say. All right, I'm not God, but I'm a God. I'm godly. So you're really just going to want to do what I say. All right, fine, fuck. I'm not a God, but I talk to him. Yep, I talk to him. So, I can tell him about you. So you're really just going to want to do what I say. All right, fine. I don't talk to him, but I do his will. I have, some church friends who explain through their interpretations of the Bible what the will of God is, and that's what I carry out here on earth for God. So you're just going to want to do what I say. Okay. Okay. I don't do the will of God. And yeah, now that I think about it, that does sound really stupid. But you know what it is? I do the will of the people. I do what the people want. I am a representative of the people. I ensure the, what's a good way to say it? The common good. That's the ticket. And you know what good means. Not bad. So you're really just gonna wanna do what I say. Okay. I don't do the will of the people. And yes, again, now that I think about it, it sounds really stupid. But you know what it is? Like, some people are not always smart enough. They don't have the foresight to understand exactly what's good for them. So sometimes I have to do things that I know are good for the people, even if it seems like it's against their will. That's my job. The people can't be expected to understand everything. It's a complex, it's a difficult world. I have to do things that I know will be good for people, even if it's not technically the will of the people. And yes, I know the people can't have a will, okay? But you're really just going to want to do what I say. Fine. Look, I'll level with you. I don't do things because I think they'll be good for most people. I do these things and I seek this power because it benefits me and my friends. The thing is that people gave me a lot of money to get into this position of power, and they really helped me along. And even though some of the things that I'm responsible for look really terrible, like you see these foreign wars and these piles of people's bodies, if you could just put yourself into the shoes of the people who got me elected, and you see how much that kind of stuff benefits them, I think you would really be more sympathetic to what we're doing. And let me just be totally honest with you. There are people out there plotting to kill you right now. And do you understand that the planet that we're living on is dying? And it's going to flood? And if people like me aren't here, you are SOL, buddy. SOL. So you're really just going to want to do what I say. All right, look, I'll make a deal with you. Now that you're starting to realize these things and the reality of who people like me are and the true nature of what we're trying to do, here's what I can do. Because I'm worried that you knowing that has the potential to make you, let's say, I don't know, disobedient. I need you to be like a piece in a machine, like a nut or a bolt in a finely tuned machine. And I'm worried that if you are aware of these things, you're going to be looking at these things and gumming up the work, so to speak. So what if I could, let's say, I don't know, make a bunch of money available for your kid to go to college? And maybe I could take care of some of your healthcare needs. And that way, you know, instead of you being focused on all this theft and murder and opportunity costs and compromise of your child's future prosperity, you can just get really excited and even grateful about all the little things that I'm doing for you right now. And I want you to know, I want to be very clear, that if you put up enough resistance, I will just kill you. All right, transaction complete. And that's, you know, that's mythology. You make no progress. And of course, the voice that you could not hear is the voice of reason, the voice of curiosity, the voice of expanding knowledge throughout time. But, of course, this is just like a silly little exercise and probably seems very reductive since I'm leaving out huge, huge chunks of history to show the progression of statism over the course of a few thousand years. So it brings up the question, where did the state come from? Because we've certainly been led to believe that it is natural for our prosperity and our survival, which is strange. But certainly most people believe that, that the state is a natural piece, you know, just like slavery was, of human existence. I've been told more than once that I need to accept statism, that people need government, that it is human nature. People need and want leaders, that is natural. So I'm interested in looking at that claim a little closer. For the better part of the last 300,000 years, our species, which I'm pooling together, Homo sapiens, which takes us back maybe 10,000 years, Cro-Magnon man, which takes us back about 40,000 years, and our earlier ancestors, you know, tool-using, art-creating, dead-burying hominids, existed without any state at all. But I want to be very clear, I'm not describing this as some kind of utopian world. Survival was pretty much dependent on violence and inbreeding. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, violence against each other, or even really what should be called violence, but a violent lifestyle. It wasn't like going up to the deli and saying, I'll take 2 pounds of 85% lean. You were smashing things with rocks until blood squirted out, and that could kind of desensitize people to violence. Now, the inbreeding was necessary because people lived in small groups. And for the purpose of procreating, they needed to frequently approach members of their own family. But because of this lifestyle, people were inclined to accept leaders. Because, and the criteria for being a leader or somebody wise or the person that somebody would turn to or rely on in the group was because they were trustworthy and they were reliable. And first and foremost, they were part of the group. So if you think about the environment that many of these early ancestors lived in, the fear, the confusion, the instability, yeah, I think that there was some comfort in having somebody who would kind of take on this role of knowing what to do. It's unfortunate, though, that people are willing to accept the same mode of group management or group functioning that was used thousands of years ago today, when the people who are claiming to be the leaders are not part of the group. They are not reliable. They are not trustworthy. But like, hey, if it was good enough for our Cro-Magnon ancestors. And the truth is that when it came to each other, people were just not that violent, it doesn't really seem. Well, from what we can gather anthropologically. Because the earth was so vast. If there was, you know, two groups of people that stumbled across each other, even if they didn't get along, like, why fight? Why fight? Just go somewhere else. But eventually, as humans propagated, there would be conflict when they would bump into each other, and maybe there just wouldn't be another place that they knew about to go to. So eventually you could say that there was the development of some people who took on the role of warriors or fighters. It was a natural transfer, you know, from being a hunter to being a warrior. And maybe even within these groups of people, there developed a division of labor where some people became the warriors. Now, Robert Higgs, who I'll put a link to some of his stuff in the show notes,
talked about this idea, this theory, and he called this phenomenon the germ of government, which he described as a group of people with a comparative advantage in wielding violence, living at the expense of others. Because what Higgs claimed happened is that when the warriors didn't have anyone to war against, they just took this advantage, this ability or skill that they had for enacting violence, and they turned on their own. The germ of government. Homo sapiens begin with the agricultural revolution, and I think it's safe to say that everybody didn't just get it all at once. The transition from a nomadic lifestyle to a settled condition of, you know, one place farming or, you know, controlling animals or using animals for food and labor in a controlled way, it could have happened over generations, over centuries, over millennia. So if everybody didn't get it all at once, maybe some people who, you know, settled and became the farmers, for the nomadic hunters, instead of just hunting the animals, they also started to hunt humans who conveniently stayed in one place and gathered up a bunch of food or grew a bunch of food or maintained a bunch of animals in that place. How easy! How easy! It's like, oh, they put everything right there. They even put a fence around the animals. We'll just kill them, then we'll kill the animals, and great. And let me just make sure I'm being clear here. I'm not suggesting that this is how all of the people thought. There's some people, let's kill them and take their stuff. But because of their division of labor, if some of them had just been conditioned to approach every problem with some kind of violent solution, that would be what they do. And I think this makes a lot of sense, that government is not a somewhat modern response to the problem of ancient violence, predation, and theft. It is the modern incarnation of the problem of ancient violence, predation, and theft. But what Higgs also points out is that for about 99% of the entire span of the species, there was no government. And while that certainly wasn't utopian, I really think that it's hard to make the argument that it is natural. It seems like government came about out of the lack of knowledge. Government is not the condition of humanity. It's not a prerequisite for our survival. It's like a current problem that we are trying to deal with, that we are trying to evolve beyond.
Many might try to argue that, yeah, even though the species has been around for hundreds of thousands of years and governments have only existed for the last 5,000 years, the last 5,000 years is when all the good stuff happened. I'd like to point out there was some bad stuff too. But if you think again about the way we learn history, think about the treatment of ancient Egypt, right? The first great civilization as the greatest achievement, a slave empire. I wanted to share with you a passage from a book called Man Makes Himself, the classic study of the origin and progress of man from the earliest recorded history to the rise of modern civilization, by V. Gordon Child. This is from Chapter 9, The Acceleration and Retardation of Progress, and I'm going to skip around just a little bit. The two millennia immediately preceding 3000 BC, so pre-Egypt, had witnessed discoveries in applied science that directly or indirectly affected the prosperity of millions of men and demonstrably furthered the biological welfare of our species by facilitating its multiplication. We have mentioned the following applications in science: artificial irrigation using canals and ditches, the plow, the harnessing of animal motive power, the sailboat, wheeled vehicles, orchard husbandry, fermentation, the production and use of copper, bricks, the arch, glazing, the seal, and in the earliest stages of the revolution, a solar calendar, writing, numerical notation, and bronze. The 2,000 years after the revolution, say from 2600 to 600 BC, or pretty much the entire span of Egypt, produced few contributions of anything like comparable importance to human progress. Perhaps only four achievements deserve to be put into the same category as the 15 just enumerated. They are decimal notation, Babylonia, about 2000 BC, an economical method for smelting iron on an industrial scale, 1400 BC, a truly alphabetic script, 1300 BC, and aqueducts for supplying water to cities, 700 BC. It goes into a few paragraphs of explanation about each of those four things I just mentioned, but I'm going to skip ahead. One partial explanation for such arrested growth may be detected in internal contradictions evoked within the societies by the revolution itself. The latter was made possible, it will be recalled, not only by an absolute accumulation of real wealth, but also by its concentration in the hands of gods or kings and a small class dependent on these. Such concentration was probably essential to ensure the production of the requisite surplus resources and to make these available for effective social use. Nonetheless, it meant in practice the economic degradation of the mass of the population. A lot of the primary producers, farmers, herdsmen, fishers, may, indeed, have been ameliorated by the public works promoted by the state and by the security regular government guaranteed. Yet, materially, their share of the new wealth was minimal, and socially they were sinking towards the status of tenants or even serfs. The substantial balance of the new surplus was retained by the few, the kings, the priests, their relatives, and favorites. Society is divided into economic classes. A ruling class of kings, priests, and officials is contrasted to the lower classes of peasants and manual laborers. The division is typified for the archaeologist by the contrast between the overpowering magnificence of royal tombs and the simplicity of private graves in Egypt, or by that between the luxurious houses of merchants and the hovels of artisans in an Indus city. That does not mean that such a class division was itself likely to accelerate further progress. On the contrary, it should retard it. Progress before the revolution had consisted in improvements in productive processes made presumably by the actual producers, and made, moreover, in the teeth of superstitions that discourage all innovations as dangerous. But by the revolution, the actual producers, formerly so fertile in invention, were reduced to the position of lower classes. The ruling classes, who now emerged, owed their power largely to the exploitations of just those hampering superstitions. The Egyptian pharaoh may have started as a magician. In any case, he did claim to be a god and spent much of his time performing magic rites. The first beneficiaries of the revolution in Sumer were the temple priests. The king, when he emerges here, is closely associated with the god whom he impersonates in periodical ceremonies. It is hardly to be expected that ruling classes with such affiliations should be patrons of rational science. They were too deeply implicated in the encouragement of hopes which experience was repeatedly showing to be illusory, but which still deterred men from pursuing the harder road of sustained and intense thinking. And in fact, such rulers had few incentives to encourage invention. Many of the revolutionary steps in progress, the harnessing of animals' motive power, the sail, metal tools, originally appeared as labor-saving devices. But the new rulers now commanded almost unlimited reserves of labor recruited from subjects fired with superstitious faith and captives taken in war. They had no need to bother about labor-saving inventions. In addition to the internal contradictions just explained, the ancient Oriental civilizations were involved in an external contradiction of a similar nature. As we have seen, neither the Nile Valley nor Babylonia was self-sufficing. Even when united in a single political or economic system, each country was forced to rely for essential raw materials on imports from regions occupied by different societies. The necessary imports had presumably once been obtained by a free exchange of surplus products, but reasons have been given for the belief that the supplies thus obtained did not suffice to meet the demands of Egyptians and Sumerians enriched by the urban revolution. They accordingly attempted to expedite and regularize deliveries by force. Armies followed the routes opened up by merchant caravans. Eventually, attempts were made to annex the sources of the supplies and to conquer the exporting countries. As the rulers of Sumerian cities had aimed at giving a political form to the geographical unity of Babylonia by subjugating neighboring cities, so they sought to extend their domains by annexing geographically distant regions essential to the stability of their economy. They came thus to embark upon a course of imperialist conquest. The empire founded by Sargon of Argade about 2500 BC is the first recorded realization of this endeavor. Congratulations, Sargon. Now, at this point, I think you kind of get where I'm going with all this, so I'm just going to skip ahead to the end. But let's go back to our world history government school myths about Egypt for a minute. This is great progress. And what is the government school definition of progress, apparently? When violence and superstition stop progress. One more paragraph. The urban revolution, made possible by science, was exploited by superstition. The principal beneficiaries from the achievements of farmers and artisans were priests and kings. Magic, rather than science, was thereby enthroned and invested with the authority of temporal power. All right, fine, Brett. Maybe a lot of the good stuff that's happened in the last few thousand years has been more like in spite of government than because of government. But it's been around long enough that most people are used to it and they're dependent on it, and now they need it. And because of that, it's a good thing. Well, that brings us all the way back to the question that I asked at the beginning of the show. What if we all woke up tomorrow and government was just gone? Now, I followed this question up at the beginning of the show by suggesting that I was going to try and create the worst case scenario. I really can't say it's definitively the worst case scenario because obviously there's too many variables, but I presented the idea that I was going to follow a really catastrophic chain of events forward to an outcome. So this is interesting. I'm actually going to catastrophize against an outcome that I actually find desirable, which I think a lot of people with other outcomes in mind, the political folks, you don't hear them do this. Now, of course, I should also point out, 90% of people in this country have been educated to be managed. So I think most of the people who are thinking about the emergence, the eventual emergence of a stateless society, are more realistic about the fact that there is probably going to be some kind of important transition. And that's really why I've resigned myself to trying to deal with the government education piece of it. Because I really think that that needs to go first. That is the goose that lays the golden eggs of obedient, conformist, and apathetic people who are willing to passively accept inverted logical pyramids of mythology and, of course, all of the nonsense ideologies that are needed to come in and prop up that pyramid and prevent it from tipping over. So I really think education, government education, needs to go first because right now it's educating people to accept a form of slavery. So we all wake up tomorrow and government is gone. Let's start to take a look at what might happen in a really, really bad chain of events. And I've done this before because when I express my ideas or try to articulate my philosophy to other people, they will often say, wait a minute. You're talking about anarchy. Like, wait a minute. You've gone crazy. And then I'll kind of walk them through this situation. What would we get in one of the worst possible outcomes of my ideas if they came to be in the most unexpected and reckless way possible. Like, boom, tomorrow. Let's catastrophize. I'll let me help you out. I'm comfortable enough with what I believe to try this out. So let's begin. We wake up tomorrow, the government is gone. Worst case scenario, what happens? Well, I'm considering the economic situation that most people find themselves in, I think that in the worst case, there would be a spike in property crime, in theft. So, you know, there would be some looting, I would think. Now, how long this could go on for, I really don't know, because there would obviously be a demand for protection, especially among, you know, business owners. But let's just say in this catastrophe land that things are even too chaotic for anybody to try and deliver a service like that. So things get worse. So now, after this spike in property crime, there is also a spike in violence. First, probably people trying to defend their property, even though that in many cases that might be justifiable. But also, very quickly, that's not going to just be a deterrent in the worst case scenario. People doing the property crime are also going to start using violence in furtherance of their theft. So now things are getting worse. But it's still probably less compared to what the state was doing. But let's not look at the bright side here. This is a catastrophe. So let's keep going. Now, I think that we can all admit that if the world changed so dramatically overnight, there would be what we could call a decompression period. People taking advantage, people panicking, people acting out in irrational ways because of the panic. But eventually, and probably I wouldn't think it would take too long, the defender of the state would even have to admit that that would have to slow down. Because people simply cannot use violence on a massive scale to conduct their day-to-day affairs. Like, they have friends, they have family, they have people that depend on them and people that they depend on. Mom can't grab a 45 every time she needs to go get a half a gallon of milk while little Billy sits at the breakfast table with a bowl of dry Cheerios. People could not live like that. That would not last. But wait. Getting positive again. How can I make this worse? All right, so even if most people turned out to be rational and peaceful, like it wasn't the very, very slim chance of getting caught for doing a crime that was stopping them. Like even today, with all the law enforcement apparatus that we have, I think a murderer has like a 1 in 4 chance of getting caught. So it's not, I really don't think it's the risk of getting caught or the risk of penalty that stops people from aggressing against other people. It's just not a good way to live. It's just not a good way to operate. Like, obviously when it comes to morality, but even when it comes to practicality. But I'm so positive. I need to make this worse. All right, so even though most people have calmed down, there are still bad people. There's always going to be bad people. And they've decided, for whatever reason, that they are going to continue to conduct their affairs this way. Just going around enacting random violence on whoever they want for whatever they need. So things are still bad. But sooner or later, they would realize that they were a drastically outnumbered minority, and their own life would be in jeopardy constantly as they tried to get the things that they desired. Now, would they just stop? Not in Mad Maxville, they wouldn't. In the worst case scenario, these kinds of people would start to band together and do their violence in greater numbers to increase their chances of success. So over time, maybe it would take, you know, a few months, a few years, a decade, who knows? What we would have, I think, is this group, these groups, really. There'd be multiple groups in the worst case. There'd be a lot of these groups that just kind of maraud around and find a community of people that are being productive and cooperative and engaging in mutually beneficial transactions and relationships. And they would say, "Ah, we should go kill those people and take all their stuff." But then if that happened enough, those bandits, those marauders, wouldn't be able to get any more stuff because they don't know how to do anything except violence. So they would die out. Well, wait a minute. There's got to be a way to make that worse. All right. They would be smart enough to realize that they can't kill the people because then they won't make any stuff. So they would just go back periodically to the place where people were being productive, and they would pillage and loot and leave the people alive to make more stuff. Now, I guess over time, even that would become tiring. So what's a way to step this up into more of a catastrophe? Eventually, the marauders decide that it doesn't make sense. All this back and forth is not efficient. So what they decide to do, in my horrible vision of the future, is they just move in to the productive community. And they say, "We're here. We're going to take your stuff when we want it. And if you don't like it, we'll kill you." But still, they would just be a tiny minority. You would think that there would be uprisings against these thugs all the time, because they just represent this tiny little part of the population of all these productive people. So they would be dramatically outnumbered. But in the darkest corners of my imagination, that is not where this ends. Maybe they would be clever enough to strike a deal with the people. Like, "Hey, listen, I know that we're here and we, you know, take your stuff whenever we wanted. But what if, like, in exchange for that arrangement, we'll, like, throw up a building here or throw some pavement down over there. You know, we'll do little things for the community as long as you let us stay here and prey upon you without any fuss." And as you already all know, we are awesome at doing violence. But we have to tell you, we're not the most violent gang out there. Right over the hill, there's an even more violent gang. And what if they came here? So we'll also, in exchange for being able to loot from your productivity, we'll also protect you if somebody else comes here and tries to do the same thing. Now, I think that could work for a while. But eventually, wouldn't somebody just say, "This is insulting. This is bribery. I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be robbed in exchange for, like, little petty favors that could be just as easily done by somebody else. And I don't want to accept all of this robbery just because of some scare story about some other violent gang possibly coming here. There's a violent gang already here. So where could the thugs go from here? This is tough." If that idea caught on, they would always have to be trying to do more stuff. That's it. Maybe they could come up with something like a daycare service. See, if they were really diabolical, this is what they would try to do. They would come up with, like, a daycare service that they could put all the children into during the day, and that way both of the parents could work and produce even more, and then the thugs could take even more. Oh, God, this is getting really terrible. And what if, imagine this, if in these daycare centers that they were running, they started to teach the children about how what they're doing is not only necessary, while their parents weren't anywhere around, they were teaching these children how the way that they operate is not only necessary, but it's actually good. Well, friends, in the worst case scenario, within a generation, the thugs would have no more problems, because all of their violence and predation would be invisible. And from there, they could pretty much do whatever they wanted. As my vision grows darker, other gangs of thugs would see this model of community management, and they would start setting up similar systems in other places. They would still be plenty violent, and they would fight with each other, and they would slaughter thousands of the innocent people they're preying on in the process. And this is truly terrible, but because of the messages that they absorbed at daycare, they would even cheer when the gang that preys on them slaughtered people that other gangs prey on in some kind of competition for more resources or territory. It could get that bad. But eventually, if this got bad enough and continued long enough, the entire planet could just become segmented into these gang territories, where a gang controls a host population that they suck off of. And at this most tragic ending, a good person, a hard-working and peaceful person who just wanted to live their life free of coercion, would realize they had no place on earth they could go. The end. And if, by any chance, you are a person who is supporting the state today for the reasons I described at the very beginning of the show, and you think that you could come up with an outcome that would be more unfortunate for more people than the one I just described, I would love to hear from you. But of course, if you are a person supporting the state today, you probably just realized, based on your current beliefs, that you'd actually be very, very comfortable with the outcome I just described. Hi everyone, this is Brett Vinat, the host of School Sucks Podcast. If you've listened to the show and said something like, huh, I learned something today, or, that made me laugh, or even, boy, this show really sucks, but it seems like a lot of work, consider becoming a subscriber. You can learn how to do so by visiting our new website at schoolsucksproject.com and clicking the support button in the left-hand menu column. And while you're there, generously agreeing to give us a little bit of your money every month, register for an account, make a profile, and join our forums. The support is very important. And about 6 months ago, we got a really nice boost from our friend Jason Osborne out in Ohio. And he helped the show reach a lot of new listeners. But we'd like to continue to expand and grow. We just started a new website, and we'd like to take the project to the next step soon. So your help would be greatly appreciated. Again, visit schoolsucksproject.com and click support to learn how you can help. Thanks.